We have 30 minutes for questions and answers and comments. We will ask all the speakers to come on the stage. So while they are preparing on the stage, I would like to summarize some of the key points that were raised in the presentation. So we had many speakers this morning linking food security to security globally, and that the food security challenges that we know today emerge from a set of circumstances all happening together, so creating a dramatic effects. And one country at a time, country variation and food security will be one country at a time. The importance to work at the farming level to connect the farmers to markets, but as well at the household level where food security is felt. And we had as well a very strong point of view of a farmer organization, what needs to be done. So the floor is yours. Please introduce yourself. Be brief in your question and comments. And if it's a question, I would welcome you to say to who you want to ask the question or to the panel, whoever is ready to. So we will alternate the microphones. We will start at my right.
Cornelius from the Canadian Food Grains Bank. Question for Mr. Torero from IFPRI. You've talked about what you saw as fairly quick transmission of prices to international prices to consumers in national markets. Our experience has been, though, as international prices have fallen, that we haven't seen that same transmission in terms of falling of domestic prices. Do you have any explanation as to why we're not seeing that transmission on the way down as we saw on the way up?
Yes, please.
You're completely right. That's what we are also observing. The transmission that I was talking was during the spike, during the increase, not during the falling. And the falling, we have found also a lot of stickiness to fall the prices. And one of the potential reasons behind is the market structure at the country level. So basically what happens is that there could be a lot of concentration in the delivery of the goods at the country level, which doesn't allow the prices to fall as quick as they will do when they go up because of international prices. So I think that the stickiness going down is more a country-level problem than an international-level transmission mechanism.
Thanks. One point to add?
During the financial crisis, we also seen...
A microphone, please, technicians.
We've also seen exchange rate devaluations, which also mean that food imports have become more expensive, and that also have kept prices up at the local level during the decline of prices.
Thanks for this explanation. My left.
Conley, the Aquaculture Communications Group. There's been a couple of times that you mentioned cell phone use and access to markets by farmers. And I'm curious how that works because in Canada, our monthly cell phone bills probably exceed the total annual income of some of these people. So I'd like to know how that works because I'd like to get on that plan.
Whoever wants to take the question, Dr. Torero?
No, sure. We are doing a lot of these things in Africa, for example, right now, and in Latin America. Basically, these farmers have prepaid phones. Okay, which, of course, the minute is more expensive than your minute here in Canada. But what allows the prepaid phones is for them to control their expenditures so that they don't have the problem that you are saying. And what they do is basically there is a system of prices where you send a four-digit code for the commodity you want to look to a price, and the cellular phone will send you a message back with the price that you want to look. Now, what is the problem? One of the problems are that in some countries, for example, the cellular companies have been able to negotiate so that this is done free, because the price information came from government agencies in most of the cases. In other countries, the cellular phone companies are charging or are taking innovation on that. The reason why is because why it should be free in some cases is because they create more traffic, more use of cellular phones, and therefore they can have a parallel benefit on it. So there are solutions that are working and are moving very fast. India is one of the pioneers in these systems. There are some problems in terms of the specific characteristics of the commodity. Like some of the price systems I have seen, the farmers complain that they don't have the information on the product that they exactly are selling, and therefore the price they're getting, although it's from the previous day or the same day, is not necessarily appropriate to what they want to sell. But there is a lot of improvement in that.
Thanks. At my left.
Okay.
At my right.
Sam Gamada, Ag Canada. I've been thinking about this just throughout the last couple of days. The issue about access to markets for farmers, it's been emphasized as being very important. In terms of the Doha round of negotiations, there's the issue of reducing domestic tariffs, but at the same time, market access. Now, if you have market access for developing countries, I can understand that, but if it's a total access, how does the small, very low productive farmer compete with international producers that will have access to the same market?
Do you have a particular person to who you ask the question to the panel? Okay, Doug and Dr. Torero.
Go ahead. Look, I think that the issue of market access is more complicated than just a tariff issue. We did a study for sub-Saharan Africa, and we looked how good was the market access in terms of tariffs and so on, and what was the level of exports. And what we found was that the average market access was pretty good, but it was not. They didn't have the level of exports that they were supposed to have with that level of market access. But the problem, there were two problems. One was there was a huge variance, so there were countries with a very low market access and countries with very good market access. And the second problem, and the variable that could explain a lot the under-exporting, for example, of these countries, was the lack of infrastructure. So when we put in infrastructure, this improved significantly the amount of exports. Now, how this is linked to smallholders and poor, which was more your question. I think that we need to be careful on this. How we are looking at this is that you have a lot of heterogeneity. Okay, of course, you will have some small producers that can coordinate between them, and they can be, of course, export-oriented and be very dynamic. But then you also have the extreme case, which is smallholders, which have huge transaction costs. They are very isolated because of lack of infrastructure and so on. And for them, it will be extremely difficult to compete. But for them, it's extremely important to get goods at a cheaper price. So having a Doha round benefits them on that side, and we really don't believe that it will compete with what they are producing mostly for self-consumption. So the issue is how we can promote these smallholders so that they can move into this dynamic market over time. But I don't think Doha is a threat to them in that sense, because basically what they produce at this point is most for self-consumption and for local markets, which won't be affected. But they will get at the same time cheaper goods if Doha gets into play.
Doug?
Let me talk about it in terms of the negotiations themselves. And let me start with a comment that Chris Delgado made yesterday, and that is countries don't trust each other. The developing world did not feel very good after they saw the results of the Uruguay round. They did not feel they got sufficient attention to their issues. They're reluctant to go into this round. And then you have the run-up in commodity prices. They have less trust in the market than they did even before. And then we had the financial meltdown in the developed world, which spilled over into the developing world. So they're pretty cautious about offering greater market access so that the volatility can spill into their own economies. That really is the basis of the negotiation. It's very clear in the Indian position. You will also see it in other countries' positions. But that's what they are struggling with right now on the trade-off between lowering subsidies and hopefully raising prices in the developed world economies, particularly North America and Europe, and on the other hand, giving greater access for those commodities in trade. The one point I keep making time after time, and that is it was made this morning in one of the speeches, you cannot resolve the global food security problem one country at a time. Neil, it was your comment. Unless you have that open trade with access, and relatively stable markets and the mechanisms and institutions in place to assure that, I don't think you can get a very big Doha round result.
Mr. Brink.
Points. First of all, smallholders are generally net buyers of food. They might sell some during the harvest time, but then after a couple of months, their stock run out, and they have to start buying. And on a net basis, because of the price variation as well, they're net buyers over the year. Secondly, independent of the market access, what is developing in global food markets is the global supply chains, the supermarkets of the world, integrating their production, distribution, and supply chain, also in setting high standards for on-time delivery, quality, and quantity that are very difficult to meet by smallholder farmers.
Thank you, Mr. Brinkman. Madame?
Bonjour. Audrey Yang, Bioresource Engineering student at McGill University. This summer, I had the opportunity with two of my colleagues to go to Benin in West Africa and to participate into a project concerning improving rice processing strategies. And during our project, we had the chance to meet some women co-ops over there and to assess the situation of these women in their difficulties in their everyday work. And before we left, in a kind of last hope, they asked us if we could do something for them when we were leaving and coming back to Canada. And I don't think I have the power to do such thing, but at least today I will speak in their name and I will ask if fair trade couldn't be a solution to help these farmers attain better equality and to attain also food security. Thank you.
Thanks for your voice and your question. So who would like to offer comments? What about fair trade? Mr. Brinkman.
I'm really not a specialist on fair trade, but my understanding is that indeed the percentage of the price that actually goes to the farmer, and as we have seen from Massimo's presentation, is actually the translation of international prices to farm level prices is very poor. And I do think fair trade can play a role in making sure that the farmers get a larger share of the international price of what you pay in the store for coffee, for example, or bananas. There is a market power at the intermediate stages, controlled by international corporations or the global supply chains that I just mentioned. And if we can get a little bit more of the margins are in between to the producers themselves through fair trade mechanisms, I do think that's a good thing. I don't think that's the only way, but I do think that contributes to the goal that we have.
Any other comments? Dr. Torrijos?
And a small comment in addition and for information. There is a paper by Alain de Jambry and Sotolet that looks into the effects of fair trade at the global level, and what they show at the end is that there is really not too much of an effect, too much of a difference in equilibrium, general equilibrium, because of the rollout of so more people come into play and then the price goes. If you compare prices under fair trade with prices of organic, for example, organic mango, in countries and the price they receive for fair trade and the price they receive for first quality cane mango, it will be very similar. So we need to be careful. It's a pretty small segment, and as was mentioned before, it could be a good idea, but it needs a lot of work still. Right now, doesn't seem to be the solution, but it's a great idea to try to find ways to differentiate. But the institutional design has to be thought carefully, because up to what I have seen, certification for fair trade implies being linked and spending some resources, and normally companies will do a joint application, and that's also a hold up on the side of the company to get some of the benefits from that.
Monsieur?
Hello, my name is Lazar Conforti. I work for Equitaire, a Montreal NGO. And what we've heard for the past 2 days, and even within this session here, is that, when markets fail, we need more markets, which is kind of like saying the markets are the cause and solution to all of life's problems, which is somewhat contradictory. And it's odd to prescribe your cause as a medicine. But anyway, I think that comes from there being two kinds of markets, because Mr. Brickman, you spoke of Amartya Sen and of assets having to benefit the poor and have a kind of, and yesterday we even mentioned equitable integration into value chains, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm wondering if you make this kind of differentiation between a market that works for the poor and for food security and one that doesn't, because, I mean, a market is just what people do to produce and sell their things. There's so many different ways of doing that. And I guess the distinction I'm trying to make goes back to one that was made over 50 years ago, one of an embedded and a disembedded market. And when we speak of Amartya Sen and markets working for the poor, we might be talking about an embedded one. But when we speak of liberalization, and with that, I mean, the fact that supermarkets, that was also brought up, how much power they have in determining who produces what and where, that's a direct result of liberalization. That's no accident, and that's a kind of market that doesn't really work for the poor and doesn't really work for food security. So do you think this is a valid distinction to make, and what implications does that have for global policy?
To one particular speaker?
No, to the whole panel, I think.
Okay, thank you for your question. Mr. Brinkman.
I'm not sure we can talk about two different kinds of markets. I think we need to make sure that the markets that are there work well for the poor. But indeed, markets need support, needs institutions, need infrastructure. They need a legal structure. They need a weight and standards that are set by the government or by the private sector, but they need to be adhered to. In remote areas of Africa, for example, they're not even scales. When they have a cup to measure the amount of food that you buy, and if the price go up, they change the size of the cup. They keep the price the same. And that's based on the trust that is there between the buyer and the seller. And the trust is an amorphous concept that are based on social constructs. And that's the kind of institutions that support markets, both formal through legal systems and informal through social relations, is absolutely critical. And you cannot get markets to work properly without that. In a way, we've seen some of that also in the financial crisis that happened last year, that there was not proper regulation or not proper controls on the market so that they can actually work properly. Markets don't work in a vacuum. There's no doubt about that. And they need to, for the poor in particular, you need supporting institutions. And some of them can go through the markets. Like, for example, the index-based weather insurance system. That can potentially work through market systems. And some of the WFP have actually done and show that it could actually work. So we really have to make sure that markets work for everyone. It's markets where possible and governments where needed.
Thanks. Mr. Conklin?
Yeah, I think maybe some of the difficulty comes with the meanings that we assign to the word liberalization. I certainly agree that I don't think it's a matter of two different kinds of markets. It's how we make markets work. And markets are human institutions, and they involve not only exchanges between private individuals and individuals and companies, but they also involve all kinds of social norms, cultural institutions, and government intervention to try to make them work better. I think what we've seen is that as we're trying to make markets work better, we have to remember that we can see failure of policy just as we see failure of governments. And I think the examples that we saw in the case of Bangladesh and India, your example of rice, with the export bans being put in place, and those certainly happened on a broader basis than just that one case over the last few years. Those are examples of policy failure, where if we hadn't had that government intervention, markets would have worked better and helped to buffer some of the shocks that we experienced. So I think that's exactly right. It's getting the combination of government policy and private sector incentives aligned.
Thanks. Question?
Mushtaq Ahmed, ag specialist with ADDI, SIDA. My question is mainly to Hank and Maximo. Hank, you talk about the poverty-hunger nexus and the interface being market. It could be a problem, it could be a solution. I see it more as a solution in the sense that by connecting the markets, you do get the right prices, the livelihoods for the people who are producing, the small farmers. They are not connected. They sell at a price when the for the commodities when it is low, and buy the inputs at a high price from the markets when you are talking about some modern agriculture. Now, internally, domestically, what you find that agricultural terms of trade is very much against the agricultural products vis-a-vis others, and that relates to low investment in agriculture and massive transfer of resources out of agriculture to the urban or other manufacturing sectors. So that is an important problem. Saying that, where Doha round is hung up now, and what do we do in the interim? Do we go for, like, in the face of globalization, the small farmers, the greater integration of the global food chain? How do we prepare the small farmers in this process? There are some programs like Regoverning Markets, USAID and others have committed to that, which retools the small farmers in the face of this changing scenario. And then there is the TRTA, like the trade-related technical assistance. Should we go in for more of that type of situation where we can provide the developing countries with the necessary capacity to negotiate in these rounds of negotiation? So we need some way forward in some suggestions. We have very well mapped the issues that's outstanding. The other question that relates to Dr. Mario Maximo, is when we, IFPRI is a great think tank, of course, so these models and everything. When we are using this time series, there is a caveat there. Time series gives significance to estimated parameters most of the time. So what I would suggest is, why don't you do something like component analysis or decomposition analysis, whereby you actually see before and after effect and then try to relate it? Because most of the, yes, we know the stickiness of the prices as an economist, that there will be prices don't move down as fast as they do rise. But, and there are, of course, the exchange issue that Hank has brought up. But on the other hand, we need to really see the causality, because there is a co-variation which can be spurious as well if we try to find causality in them. Thank you.
Thanks, Mushtaq. So, Mr. Brickman and
yes,
Dr. Torrego.
I very much agree that there was a bias against agriculture, and partly because of the low food prices or prices in general for agricultural commodities. That lasted for quite a long time. I do think there was also among development economists a bias against agriculture and amongst governments. The early development economists were very much focused on manufacturing and industrialization. We need to industrialize. We need to get out of agriculture. And that really, I think, set a bias against agriculture. I mean, it was also something like the urban bias, because the political supports of governments were mostly in cities. That also increased that. So I do think, actually, that this current crisis creates an opportunity to correct that bias. And I think we have seen something of that through the G8 initiative and the focus over the last 2 years that really focus on food security and agriculture again. And I think that's a good thing. we need to focus on, we need to invest in agriculture. I do think we need also to invest in food assistance and emergency assistance and nutrition at a two-track approach, because agriculture in itself will not solve, for example, the malnutrition problems that we have at the moment. But definitely we need to invest in productivity increases at the smallholder level. That there's no doubt about that. And that will then allow farmers to participate not only in local markets much more, but also in international markets. May I just mention one point, that after the Uruguay round was concluded, which was agriculture was included for the first time, a lot of simulations were done about the impact of the Uruguay round. And one consistency was that Africa would actually lose because, as a result of the Uruguay round, partly because agricultural subsidies would decline and prices would go up. And Africa was a net consumer, net importer of food. And that is still the case, and partly because of smallholders that are net buyers, as I just mentioned. And we need to get the production at the smallholder farmer from 1 ton a hectare to 2 or 3 or 4 ton a hectare. And then they can grow enough food for themselves. They can sell more of that and get income that stimulates the rural manufacturing sector, as has happened in countries like Japan and Korea, for example. There's no country in the world that developed without an increase in agriculture productivity first, except, of course, Singapore and Hong Kong. but they relied on the productivity increases in neighboring countries to get the food. And that goes back to Europe in the 17th century.
Very good. Thank you. Dr. Torero?
Sorry if I was not clear, but when I was talking of time series, I was talking of Hamilton. So time series analysis, basically what we do is log differences. So we look into changes in the series, and we do causal tests, Granger causality tests. We do parametric Granger causality tests and non-parametric Granger causality tests. When you do the Granger causality test, you have to run it in both ways. And it's not true that you have always significant variables, because if not, then you won't have a Granger causality significant. So basically, when I am saying that there is international price transmission to local prices, that means that the causality test in that direction is significant, while the causality test in the different direction is not significant. The non-parametric is just a robustness check to take out all the parametric assumptions behind the estimation of the parametric test.
Doug, a brief comment?
If I might, Madam Chairman, I'd like to go back to the question on markets, failing markets and how we deal with them. I think it's very clear that if you understood Adam Smith, what he said was that the invisible hand, let alone in a market, would establish prices and do so to the gain of both buyer and seller. What we've also learned is that that invisible hand has to be attached to the long arm of the law. We must understand that. The other is that even in a well-functioning market, the prices and the results that come from that market have neither heart nor soul, nor correctness of distribution or ethics or anything else. The difficulties we face in regulation is that many countries, including my own, from time to time prefer to regulate a market rather than to deal with the social and economic externalities that that market is creating. And in doing so, slow trade, change the distribution of benefits that that market is telling you that the resources can offer. And I think part of the difficulty is that we use the word markets to mean a whole lot of things, and we should disassemble these issues in how policy has to treat them. You must regulate a market. My colleague is absolutely right on that. But if you want to change the results of that market that is operating properly, then you have to deal with other policies to handle the distribution issues, the equity issues, the ethical issues that that market is creating. Because if you go in and change that market, then you're going to get into what Greenspan got into, saying the market will work with no problem, let me take the regulation of it, and we end up with collapse.
Thanks. So I am in a bit of a challenge of time, so I will take four questions altogether, but be brief. A comment or a question, please.
Hi, I'm Steve Cornish from Care Canada. I have three quick questions.
One is,
I'm not quite understanding the logic. If governments are really looking at food security as a national security issue, why there wouldn't be a balance between food sovereignty and markets as a response mechanism? It would just seem a little strange that a government would want to rely completely on an external system to take care of its own internal security needs. The second is if the panel could just expand a little bit on the mechanisms for dealing with the spikes in speculation. We've heard of sort of a need to deal with, but I haven't heard much of the specifics on how that can actually be attained. And the last is on smallholders. We've heard how they haven't benefited from the trickle-down in pricing. We've heard, even in Canada, how marketing boards are almost essential for guaranteeing a proper income to those families. We've heard how, in the developing world, smallholders are net importers. So I'm just thinking that before the trickle-down and the big box stores of food supply reach down, we probably have to deal on two levels of food security, and that would partly was discussed in safety nets. But shouldn't we also be putting a lot of effort on building the resiliency of the smallholder farms that aren't going to become the new producers or that can't link up in cooperatives?
Thank you. Mister? Rapidly.
Luc Mougeau du CRDI. It seems to me, in line with what other attendees have been saying, that self-reliance is one of the elephants in the room as part of our toolkit to face the crisis to come. Given the predictable growing variability, volatility, and sensitivity of the food prices worldwide, to me would make enormous sense to, where this is possible, to lessen dependence on food imports. And again, where it is possible, to make optimal use of one's assets and potential to increase resilience against adversity. And there are cases which I think in this conference and hopefully in the next one, we could discuss more at length, where more self-reliant food policies have been used by countries. I'd like the panel, particularly Mr. Headley and Mr. Torero, perhaps to address these cases and how they can inform other countries.
Thanks. Rapidly, the two last persons.
Hi, my name is Marion. I'm a master's student at Concordia in sociology. My focus is not so much on food security, but food sovereignty in India in response to the food crisis. And this is a question directed to Mr. Conklin and Mr. Headley in terms of what you were mentioning about the fallacy of composition and how national development in one country in trying to achieve food security undermines the security of other countries. I was wondering if you could elaborate on that, because my research, I'm focusing on how self-reliance is a more efficient and effective strategy that enables benefits to smallholder farmers and also sustainable agriculture. So if you could elaborate on that.
Thanks. Very good question. Mister?
Bonjour, René Mongeau, Art des Agronomes du Québec. My question, it will be in French. You know that it's always longer than in English, but excuse me. And I would like to ask a question to Mr. Lacasse. Monsieur Lacasse, vous avez exprimé, d'un premier temps, j'apprécie ce que vous avez dit sur l'appel à la cohérence et la campagne que vous démarrez. Et ma question, en fait, est comment, dans la philosophie de l'UPA, vous allez convaincant, quels sont vos arguments qui vont permettre l'adhérence, l'adhésion des autres partenaires?
Merci, M. Mongeau. Je vous demandais, M. Lacasse, de commencer à répondre.
En fait, il y a deux constats qu'on fait, là, je pense, au départ. Après 15-20 ans de libéralisme économique, là, particulièrement en agriculture et dans le domaine alimentaire, d'une part, on n'a pas réglé, on a même accentué un problème de faim dans le monde. Et comme je disais, la très grande majorité de ces gens-là qui souffrent de la faim sont des agriculteurs et des paysans ou des travailleurs agricoles. L'autre phénomène, c'est qu'on a, appauvri la classe agricole. Alors, les deux sont rattachés parce que, évidemment, des producteurs qui ont de moins en moins de revenus sont de moins en moins capables de se nourrir. Alors, c'est à ça qu'il faut s'attaquer. On le fait déjà depuis quelques années via UPA Développement International. Alors, on a beaucoup d'activités, là. On travaille avec des organisations agricoles en Afrique pour leur permettre de s'organiser. Parce que la solution à ça, là, moi, je pense qu'il n'y a pas d'autre façon de permettre, à travers des politiques, des programmes agricoles, permettre aux agriculteurs d'aller chercher de meilleurs prix pour la vente de leurs produits en régularisant les marchés. Et ça, ça prend des balises, ça prend des cadres, des politiques agricoles, des politiques internes dans chacun des pays qui vont favoriser ça. Le fait que les producteurs puissent s'organiser entre eux, être en mesure de négocier avec leurs acheteurs des meilleures conditions de prix. Et ça, il faut le faire à l'interne, puis il faut aussi que ça soit cohérent. Il faut amener cette cohérence-là aussi au niveau international, de façon à ce que les accords de commerce international respectent et tiennent compte des mécanismes de régulation de marché qui s'installent et qui se développent dans chacun des pays. Et quand on va avoir atteint cet objectif-là, quand on va avoir assuré une cohérence entre les efforts qui se font pour améliorer le revenu des agriculteurs à l'interne dans chacun des pays, et que ces principes-là vont être reconnus au niveau international, on va améliorer les revenus à la ferme, on va améliorer la capacité dans ces pays-là, dans l'ensemble des pays, de développer leur alimentation, leur agriculture, et de répondre mieux aux besoins de leur population en termes d'alimentation. Moi, je pense que c'est ça la recette. Et déjà, on le fait, comme je vous le disais, depuis 15 ans dans les pays. On le fait en Afrique et ça donne des résultats. Alors, c'est ça qui nous encourage et je pense que c'est ça la recette qu'il faut de plus en plus intégrer et faire en sorte là, que le mouvement va s'accentuer, va se développer à travers le monde.
Merci. While the speakers are preparing to answer, I would like to recognize one other question on this side. Your name, please.
Producteur agricole. Merci. I would like to. Some speakers spoke about the benefit of subsidy. I guess it is mainly benefit for the consumers and the benefit for the urban people. And some other people said that even the food producer in developing country are net buyer. This is probably true, but as a farmer, I think if they are net buyer, it's because they got so low yield that they don't produce even for themselves, and this is completely abnormal. My question, I would like the speaker to tell us what they consider were the influence of subsidy on the development or on the development of the agriculture in Africa. Being a producer myself, I could tell you that the for producer in Canada, the crisis was before 2006. During this period, we could get about 100 a ton for our corn in Canada, while the cost of production was 180. And we consider that one of the main reasons for this was the big subsidy offered to the producer in U.S. Some speakers spoke about the export subsidy and the other subsidy. For me, this is the same. It produces the same result. If the producer in U.S. can produce at a cost of 100 a ton, then since they are so big producer, when they have extra production for themselves, the international price is lower to $100 a ton, and it becomes the price for everybody. Some speakers spoke about the difference. Were saying that the food producers in Africa are not influenced by this. I don't quite agree with this because, I mean, many urban people in Africa, they get a big part of their food from outside market. And if these importations cut the market of the food producer in Africa, how could they develop? Thank you.
Merci. So I would like to summarize a key question. It is some about how to deal with prices trickle down, smallholders, self-reliance, and resilience. A lot of questions about that. The last question is about the impact of subsidies and how do they deal with that in Africa and what's the impact for them. So we will go one panelist at a time. It's your last chance. And after that, we conclude the session.
I'll start with the last question. I really don't think that food subsidies in general is a good idea. They have been really costly, and they are generally not targeted. I'm talking about consumer food subsidies. Producer food subsidies like we see in Europe is really under pressure in the Doha round, as they should. But I do think that there are, in certain cases, and perhaps not as the first line of defense, but maybe as the third or the fourth, a case for targeted food subsidies, really targeted on poor groups of people. And for example, the fair price shops in India is a very good example of how that can work properly. I think there are very few cases actually in Africa where it is done, except perhaps in certainly in Northern African like countries like Egypt, but they have become also they are very expensive and they are generalized, and I think that's generally a bad idea, and not targeted. On the food sovereignty issue. Let me just say that the first really proper thing to do is to optimize resources within the country. So if there is a possibility for agriculture and food production in the country, no doubt you should take that. But let's not go to the other extreme, like Saudi Arabia trying to grow wheat in the desert. That is not going to work, and the government has now recognized that it is way too expensive and not a proper use of natural resources. So we have to find some way in between of optimizing economic, as long as it's economic, to use natural resources and make sure that you have high productivity in the countries themselves. And food sovereignty does not mean food self-sufficiency. And you can reach food sovereignty while still allowing international trade to take care, in particular of when you have a shock, like in Bangladesh. Bangladesh is normally pretty self-sufficient. They grow enough rice. But you do have an occasional flood that destroys 10% or 20% of the crop, and then you need to import. And, of course, that if there are no export bans and the international markets function, that is not a problem. Just one point on the speculation. In the report that I distributed, there's an annex to Chapter 3 that talks about speculation, and you can have a look at that. It's not entirely clear what needs to be done. There are a couple of measures that have been used, increasing the margins, for example, the down payments on future contracts. Secondly, have delivery requirements. On speculation, we also need to be very clear on speculation is a good thing and a bad thing at the same time. Farmers need to speculate. They need to be able to cover themselves against price changes. When they put the seed in the ground, they need to have some security about what the price should be. And buying futures is critical to that. But when they sell, somebody needs to buy it. And who buys it? A speculator. Now, there is also another kind of speculation, and that is coming from the financial markets, and that has really been the difference over the last few years. Huge inflows of money coming from Wall Street into commodity markets, and that's not because they are growing and need to protect themselves for price fluctuations. That's because they want to make some money quickly.
I have to ask you to do it quickly because
just one more point about this. A lot of that trade is happened over the counter, and there is very little data on what actually that trade is. And transparency in these markets is absolutely the first step to know exactly what's going on. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Conklin.
Just briefly, I really appreciate the comments here, and I really like the comment about the elephant in the room, because I think that got to the point about making optimal use of our resources. And that is what markets, properly functioning markets, are all about, is helping us to find that balance in the optimal use of resources. If we can get markets to function better in countries where we're not making the best possible use of agricultural resources, then by making those markets function better, whether that's rural roads, whether that's more investment in information systems and other kinds of infrastructure, or whether it's improvement in market institutions and government regulations, those things will all help that to happen. But to try to achieve that, to try to achieve food sovereignty by cutting off trade and by distorting markets is, in fact, an approach that will lead to food insecurity, not food security.
Thanks. Doug?
I'll only add one point, and that is on the self-reliance issue. It goes back to my point earlier. Countries don't trust each other. In 1974, President Nixon stopped soybean exports to Japan. Japan, by the way, had a six-month supply. As late as 1986, there were still newspaper stories about in Japan about the U.S. trying to starve Japan. On the 25th of December, 1979, Russia invaded Afghanistan. On the 11th of January, five nations came together, including Canada, and shut down trade in cereals, food grains, to the Soviet Union. The words "food is a political weapon" became a very major issue. Countries around the world do not trust the major exporters to not stop trade. And as a result, they feel they must have some mechanisms in place within their own country to be able to deal with hunger and shortage when it occurs. There is not enough trust yet in the international markets to move to the economic utopia that I think everyone would hope for, and that is relatively open trade without closing borders in either direction. That's what we're trying to get to, and it's a matter of building that trust and getting over the history that has gone with that trade system in food over the last many, many years.
Thanks. Dr. Torrero?
I agree with everything that has been said. Let me add a few comments. The first one is on the idea of being self-sufficient versus not being self-sufficient. I think that the answer was we need to optimize, and that's correct. But what we need to think also is that we are in a global world. We need to think that countries will be facing different shocks of climate over the next years. And there is no way they can be, in most of the cases, self-sufficient in all the goods they need to consume. So there is a clear need to depend also on international trade. And as was mentioned before, this is not an easy issue, and it's true that food is an important security issue at the same time. The institution that was more attracted to us in the last year or so was the security group of the U.S. government. This is a real national security issue, and I assume in Canada is the same. We were with parliamentarians in Canada and so on. So, of course, it's a complex issue to create distrust, and the crisis of the last 2 years has increased the distrust on these things. Yeah. So we need to move forward, and we need to create a better deal that will allow countries to coordinate better. On the speculation and hedging and the difference between speculation and hedging, I'm very happy that now we are talking again back of the speculation, because this has been a very complex story since we start launching this brief of when speculation matters, because it's a pretty dogmatic issue, especially among economists. And I am an economist, so I have to excuse myself from that, but the dogma is incredible. That's why I put the picture of Greenspan. But the idea here, and I think it's completely right that there is good and bad speculation, but we call both speculation. And I agree, there is hedging, and hedging is good. The problem right now, and I was talking with Canadian parliamentarians like 3 weeks ago, and most of them are farmers, and the issue they said was, for us, it's pretty complex right now to use the futures market. Because really, the futures market was developed to discover prices, and they cannot discover prices anymore in the futures market because how things are doing. And there are two concepts which are important. One is markets are interlinked. So what happened in the financial crisis, of course, affects the agricultural market. And of course, if I have a mechanism where I can invest and get more money, I will do it. So if I see that the agricultural market has a positive trend because of the multiple reasons that we have that has been explained before on fundamentals and so on and so forth, and it's a highly concentrated market in the export side, it's a good market to put my money because I will get a high return. And
We are already 15 minutes late.
Okay. So it's an important market to work. Therefore, it's very important to try to analyze when this happens and find different solutions. In our case, and you can look in our webpage, the solutions we are pushing are a minimum physical reserve for humanitarian reasons and a virtual reserve. And we now have like 4 other documents showing that it's feasible and it's a potential good solution. And just finally, on the issue of the subsidies and the distortions, I was in Mexico, and there was the U.S. representative and the Brazilian and a previous agricultural minister of Brazil, and the issue of subsidies in biofuels came up. And the Brazilian minister told something very simple to the minister of the U.S., to the Secretary of Agriculture of the U.S., let me import ethanol to the U.S. and break down the subsidies of the U.S. and let's see who competes better. Let me compete with you, and let's see how we can optimize the use of land and water. Yeah. Thank you.
Merci. Monsieur Lacasse, quelque chose?
Oui, ben, peut-être un mot à terminer. La souveraineté alimentaire, comment on peut la définir? C'est que ça repose sur un principe de base. Il faut reconnaître que, à la base, l'alimentation des peuples ne peut pas répondre à un besoin essentiel et ne peut pas être traitée comme n'importe quelle marchandise. Ça, c'est le principe de base qu'il faut reconnaître au départ. Si on ne reconnaît pas ça, là, c'est clair que là, on embarque dans les concepts de libre commerce et d'ouverture de marché qui ont fait la démonstration au cours des 15-20 dernières années qui amènent des effets plutôt négatifs sur la capacité des peuples de se nourrir. Alors, c'est le principe de base qu'il faut reconnaître. Et ça, c'était reconnu pour la culture. La culture dans le monde n'est pas gérée par l'OMC. Elle est gérée par l'UNESCO, selon un traité aussi international, mais qui respecte à la base, parce que la culture est considérée comme faisant partie du patrimoine des pays. Or, la culture a été un traitement particulier. Tant et aussi longtemps qu'on ne reconnaîtra pas que l'agriculture doit avoir un traitement particulier, parce que l'alimentation des peuples, l'alimentation du monde, c'est un bien de première nécessité, on va être dans un courant qui va accentuer des phénomènes négatifs. Alors ça, c'est le premier principe de base. Une fois qu'on va avoir reconnu ça, qu'on va respecter aussi, qu'on va encourager des politiques pour le bon développement de l'agriculture en lien avec leurs besoins alimentaires, et qu'on va, et que ces politiques-là vont être reconnues au niveau international, on va avoir franchi des pas importants, majeurs. Et c'est ça, c'est à ça qu'il faut travailler. Il n'y a pas de recette miracle, là. Il n'y a pas de ça n'arrivera pas, ça ne tombera pas du ciel. Moi, je pense que ça repose sur la prise en main, d'abord par les agriculteurs, mais aussi par une réflexion, une prise de conscience de nos sociétés qui va amener nos gouvernements, nos États aussi, à voir l'agriculture et l'alimentation de façon différente.
Thanks. You would agree with me that we had a very sophisticated and knowledgeable panel about food security, global food security, and the relationship to markets and trade. I would like to have to add a few comments from my experience being the head of the Canadian delegation at the World Food Summit in 1996, when we set up this goal of 800 million people cut by half by 2015, and to see the trend going the reverse. I think it's a humbling experience to look at that, and we look a lot from the north, what needs to be done in the south. And a few comments I would like to offer is, first, in the South, 70% of the poors are in rural area, and the majority of agriculture is produced by women. And I think that it's something very important to understand. And smallholders' policies would need to deal with this reality. Farming is feminine in the South. And there's a lot of experience throughout the world, and when I think that one country at a time is a good strategy for improving agricultural productivity and succeeded in food security, I know from experience different countries have dealt differently with these policies with different results. So I would like to convey the students in the room to really to continue your career in this area. The world is yours. Not to do the mistakes we have done in the past. Think about the South is more and more educated. They know what needs to be done in their own country. We need to involve the grassroots movement in each country, and particularly in agriculture, and we need to involve women in solutions. And I would like to thank McGill University again, Chandra, second year with a very successful conference. Thank you for inviting me to co-chair this panel, and I wish you good food for thoughts as a follow-up of this panel this morning. So please join me in a round of applause for this very good panel. Now it's a break time. We will have a bit of a depth to the next panel because we took a bit of time for the break and the next panel. So would you mind to take 5 minutes to take food and come back to your seat so we could resume briefly? Thank you.